Abiana, who is the Research Director of the HIV-AIDS Research and Policy Institute at Chicago State University. Dr. Abiana trained as a physician in Nigeria and completed a residency training program in community medicine, which led to the award of a fellowship at the National Postgraduate Medical College of Nigeria in Public Health. Dr. Abiana is presently pursuing an MPH degree at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. So please welcome Dr. Abiana.
Thank you, and good afternoon. I think, not related to the presentation, but it's my birthday today. And thank you. It's a milestone birthday, don't guess, but it's a milestone. I'll spend the day working, so I see that I'm going to spend the year working. I'm presenting prevalence and correlates of HIV risk behaviors of inmates in a state prison system. The state here is the state of Illinois. I wondered why this was in the cultural segment, but, well, I think there's a little bit of culture, prison culture, in what inmates do. Am I doing wrong? Oh, no. Again, no relationships to disclose, like everybody else. As we all know, inmates have higher HIV and AIDS rates compared to the general population. Research, various ones have shown that the prevalence among inmates is about 4 to 10 times higher than in the general population. But the question is, what is the exact mechanism that links incarceration with HIV? Why do inmates have more HIV? If I ask that question here, everybody would have different reasons, but I think that scientifically we need to find out what the correlation is between incarceration and HIV. To answer this question, we came up with this conceptual model, which is quite self-explicit. We know that people who are HIV infected and those who aren't infected go into prison. They go there with some risk behaviors. When they get into prison, some people will get HIV from others. Some people will give HIV to others. Again, risk behaviors go on in prison. Then we release people back into the community, both those who are positive and those who are negative. When they get out, some of those who are positive will transmit the infection to others in the community, and some of those who are negative will get the infection from the community. But I think that many times people focus on those who go out to transmit the infection and not really thinking that some of them actually go into the community to get the infection. After all, it is easier to get HIV infection in the community. There are more opportunities in the community than there are in the prison. So, we know that inmates engage in risk behaviors before incarceration, during incarceration, and after incarceration. Research is out there, quite a lot of it, showing that inmates actually have more risk behaviors before they go into prison in some studies. But for us to really understand the role of incarceration in HIV infection, we need to examine the risk behaviors of inmates. And therefore, the specific objectives of this study was to describe the pre-incarceration risk behaviors of inmates, to identify and also to quantify their risk behaviors during incarceration, and also to determine the social demographic characteristics that are associated with risk behaviors while inmates are incarcerated. So this was a study that was born out of the African American HIV Act in Illinois. And so we selected 17 Illinois correctional facilities. And it was a cross-sectional study. We had both male and female inmates, which was good because many of the studies that had been done among inmates before usually focused on men. But this time, we also included women. Our participants had to be 18 years or older. They had to have been continuously incarcerated for at least 6 months. They had to be able to speak and write English because the survey instrument was in English. We used PEPI to determine our sample size. I won't go into the details of that, but at the end of the day, we had a minimum sample size of 10 to 25 individuals, and we did some oversampling to adjust for non-participation. At the end of the day, we selected 2,000 inmates randomly. We used a multi-stage sampling technique. I don't want to go into the details again, but then we got the most recent inmate lists from the correctional facilities, and then we randomly selected those who matched our criteria from those. And we use a structured questionnaire to collect our data, and we analyze using SPSS version 15, and I'll present both some descriptive and inferential statistics. And of course, our IRB approved this study. At the end of the day, we had 1,819 participants, 71% of them were men, and 29% of them were women. Response rate was 91%. It wasn't everybody that we selected who participated. We had some who did not participate. The study was entirely voluntary, and so participants had the right to refuse. Not every participant answered every question, but overall, the average response rate to the questions was 96%, which we felt was okay. Again, the number of participants that responded to each of the questions varied. So when you see some of the tables and you see the N there, the sample size, it differs from variable to variable. That's because it's not everybody who took part in the survey that answered every single question in the survey. These are the socio-demographic characteristics of our participants. We tried to do some comparison among women and men and just reported p-values. As you all expect, over 50% of the women and the men were African-American. Again, we found that there were more white women than there were white men. Many of people had been incarcerated less than four times. The men were more likely to have been incarcerated more times compared with the women. Again, looking at how many years they had spent in prison during the current incarceration, many of them had just been there for less than 1 year. Again, we had more men staying longer than women. 32% of the men had been there for 7 years or more compared to 18% of the women. A vast majority of the participants had been tested for HIV at some point, whether before they got to prison or in prison. Over 90% of the women and about 85% of the men. The difference was statistically significant. This table shows their pre-incarceration risk behaviors. We asked about behaviors in the 6 months before people were incarcerated. To preempt your questions, I'm sure somebody is going to say, why 6 months? Some people have been there for more than 7 years. There's going to be some problem of recall bias. And that's correct. But since we wanted to look at pre-incarceration risk behaviors, we had to ask these questions anyway. But in publishing our research, we have submitted a manuscript on pre-incarceration risk behaviors. We limited that analysis to people who had been in prison for less than 1 year, just to reduce the issue of recall bias. But we did find out that 59% of our participants had two or more vaginal partners in the 6 months before they were arrested. 19% had two or more anal sexual partners. 66% had never already used condoms for vaginal sex. 70% had never already used condoms for anal sex. 15% had a history of injecting drugs. Of this number, 56% had a history of sharing needles. About 73% had obtained tattoos from non-professional artists. We put that there because we know that when you get tattoos from people who are not professionals, there's a higher chance of using infected instruments, a higher chance of sharing equipment. And 41% had obtained body piercing from non-professional artists. And I put here a couple of charts just to show some male-female differences. You see that about 70% of the women are in pink, the men are in blue, had never already used condoms in the 6 months before they were arrested. That was statistically significant. For anal sex, about 71% had never already used condoms for both sexes. Again, we looked at respondents who did not use condoms during their last sexual intercourse. Now, this could have taken place in prison. This was last sexual intercourse, and it may have occurred in prison. We don't know. Again, you see that the vast majority, over 70% for every group, had not used condoms during their last sexual intercourse. Of course, more women had not used condoms compared to men. We looked at those who had ever injected drugs. More women than men reported ever injecting drugs. When I saw this at first, I felt, is somebody telling a lie here or what? But then I remembered that many of the women who are in prison are there on drug-related offenses. And so if you are looking at the prison population, it's actually possible that you find more women who had injected drugs compared to the men. The difference was statistically significant as well. We also looked at respondents who had obtained tattoos and body piercing from non-professional artists. Again, you see that more men than women had obtained tattoos from non-professional artists, which may mean that, well, the men For some behaviors, the men had more risk-taking behaviors compared with the women. The differences were statistically significant as well. Then we went on to look at their risk behaviors during the present incarceration. About 9% of them reported sexual intercourse, and about just 1% reported injection drug use. Out of this number, 0.6% reported needle sharing, 17% reported having gotten a tattoo in prison, and about 1.4% reported they had had body piercing. Now, these percentages look very low, and I'm sure you will say this is not really how it is. But tomorrow I have a poster, I can't remember, the A30 session, there's a poster there where we did focus groups with ex-offenders who had just left prison. The focus groups was meant to explore everything that we found in the survey, and it would be good if you can take a look at the poster tomorrow morning. We can say that this probably was some underreporting, but we also know that in the state of Illinois, there's a lot of tightening up in the facilities, and actually many of these behaviors are reducing. We got that much from what the ex-offenders had to tell us. Now, I just put this there to show the context of sexual intercourse. There's a lot of literature about people who are being forced to have sex in prison. In our study, 93% of the participants reported consensual sex. Only 7% reported that they were forced. And again, when we, from the results we got from the focus groups, many of the participants didn't tell us that much of the sexual intercourse that happens in prison is consensual. I mean, it's for people that really love relationships. Even though at times people do because they need something, they need security, they need money, but what it presented to us was like there wasn't as much force as, people seem to believe there was. We looked at what characteristics and behaviors were associated with sexual behavior. We couldn't look at the others because very few people reported those behaviors, but we decided to look at sexual behavior. Maybe I should just say one thing before I go on. I didn't put that slide there, that much of the sex among women was oral sex, and much of the sex among men was anal sex. And while I was analyzing this data, I wanted to know the context of the heterosexual sex that goes on in prison. I wanted to know, were conjugal visits allowed, even though from what I heard, conjugal visits aren't allowed in Illinois prisons. But I did make an effort to ask IDOC, the Illinois Department of Corrections, about whether there were conjugal visits and all that. I never got a response to that. I got two or three emails, but nobody came up with the answer to that. But from talking to the public health coordinator and all that, conjugal visits are not allowed, and so heterosexual sex goes on in prison. Again, when we did the focus groups, we were able to see who inmates sleep with, but that's not the focus of this presentation. So we looked at what characteristics and behaviors were associated with sexual behavior. We saw, just look at the red and the blue, that's the only important thing there, that the more inmates stayed in prison, the longer they stayed in prison, the more likely they were to get involved in sex. Again, take that resolve with a pinch of salt. You can see that the confidence interval is so wide, and that's because the numbers are few. We also saw that the more times people were incarcerated, the less likely they were to get involved in sexual intercourse. I really cannot explain why that is like that. It is possible that people who are incarcerated more times spend relatively shorter times in prison, and so they know, I'm going to get out soon, and so I can go and do what I like when I get out. Maybe that's the reason. Again, we saw that people who are identified, who self-identified as bisexual or gay, were more likely to have sex in prison. Again, pretty wide confidence intervals there because the numbers aren't so large. So take that also with some pinch of salt. But we did find also that people who got tattoos in prison were more likely to get to engage in sexual intercourse in prison. Now, that was interesting to me because I've read a couple of studies about HIV transmission in prison. One very popular one is the Georgia study, where they found that people who had tattoos were 10 times more likely to seroconvert in prison. And so the question for me then was, so what is tattoo? What does tattoo do? Is tattooing by itself a transmission mechanism, which means you're getting HIV from tattooing? It is theoretically possible to get HIV from tattooing, even though there hasn't been a documented case. But again, it is easy to understand why there hasn't been a documented case. If you find somebody who maybe shared needles for tattoo, the person probably has other risk behavior, so you can't tease out the fact that maybe the HIV was from the tattooing. So it's either that tattooing itself causes HIV, or maybe tattooing is a risk marker. Maybe people who get tattoos in prison are more likely to get involved in other risk behaviors. That may be what we are getting out of that. So what did we conclude? We concluded that inmates engaged in risk behaviors before and during incarceration, as you have seen. We saw that the longer inmates were incarcerated, those who identified as non-heterosexual and those who got tattoos in prison were more likely to have sexual intercourse in prison. And then we said that the findings support both the importation and the deprivation models of inmate behavior. Importation, if people who are gay and bisexual, who identify as that, are more likely to have sex in prison, that may be some kind of importation from what they their behaviors before. And deprivation, if the longer people stayed in prison, the more likely they were to engage in these behaviors, they may just be deprived of these relationships and they decide to engage in those behaviors. So what recommendations do we have? We know that HIV prevention interventions happen in every prison, I would believe, in the country, but we did recommend that, considering the fact that many of these inmates already had high-risk behaviors before they got into prison, it would be good if HIV prevention interventions are commenced for them as soon as they're incarcerated. Bearing in mind that many of them won't even stay in prison that long and will be back into the community. So the prison provides a very good opportunity for them to get real comprehensive HIV prevention, but this should be started as soon as possible after they get into prison. Again, we recommend that since behaviors continue to happen in prison, sex goes on in prison, drug use is still continuing in prison, maybe the current policies about risk reduction in prison need to be reviewed. I'm not suggesting what review needs to be done, but something has to be done. It's either corrections and public health people find a way that these risk behaviors don't happen, but if they continue to happen, then something has to be done to prevent the inmates from getting HIV from these behaviors. But that's for the policy people to decide what they're going to do about that. Well, we had a couple of limitations here, as I'm sure many of you must have gathered. There was the problem of social desirability bias, so there may have been possible underreporting of these behaviors. We used a self-administered questionnaire, and again, because of the previous bias, we cannot generalize these findings to represent other inmates. Again, we had quite a couple of non-response to our questions, and this also could pose some kind of bias. We had small numbers of inmates reporting risk behaviors, and because of this, we were not able to identify some independent risk factors for these behaviors. We also had those inmates who refused to participate in this study, and they may have differed significantly from those who participated. But the point was, we couldn't ask, because of the way the prison is, for anybody who's done research in prison, there was no way we could say anything to those who refused to participate. The setting was such that when we got into the room, and we read a script about the survey, then we asked, who doesn't want to take part in this survey? Everybody who said they didn't want to take part had to get up, and they were escorted out by the guards, and so we never saw them again. They may have differed significantly from the people who took part. I remember one side comment in one of the male facilities we went to then. As soon as we finished reading the script, and then we said, if you don't want to take part, you can please leave now. In that room, we got over 50% of the guys leaving. And some of the people who stayed, I remember one side comment, the person said, you want to ask about sex and about risk behaviors? Those are the people you should ask. Those are the people walking away. You know, so and that's to say, well, the results we have all those biases there. And there's really nothing you can do in a voluntary survey to prevent those kind of biases. So what are we doing after this? We hope to look at the role of tattooing in HIV transmission in prison. Like I said, is it a risk marker or is it a mode of transmission? We're also interested in the risk behaviors of partners of inmates. Remember, these inmates come out of prison to meet partners they had left behind. And even though people seem to think the prisoners are the ones who bring the HIV, they actually could be also victims when they get out. We're also at this point planning to do a spatial analysis of inmate residences after they're released to map that against the distribution of HIV cases and HIV prevention services in Illinois. So we thank Dr. Nkobo Jirel. She was the PI of this study before I got to work there. She left. We also thank our research assistants and State Rep Constance Howard, who sponsored the bill that provided the money for this study, and of course IDOC officials, who were marvelous. It was difficult getting to the prison, but they were good to us, and eventually we were able to get in to do our study. We also thank the Illinois General Assembly and the IDPH for providing the funds for this study. And of course, we have to put a disclaimer that everything I've said here is just the opinion of the authors and our conclusions. It has nothing to do with the General Assembly or the IDPH. Yeah, there will be questions, but I thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Dr. Abiana. Our final speaker for this afternoon before we entertain